Disc 6.
The Mongols have 4 required runs each year. The New Year's run is one of them, but the beginning of 2000 wasn't one of my brightest moments. My mood was pretty dark indeed, and the last thing I felt like doing was celebrating. My aunt, who'd raised me and who'd loved me with a kind of love that I never felt from anyone else in my life, had recently passed away. Her name was Johnny, and she was the kindest person I have ever known. Simply put, my biological father and mother weren't prepared for the obligations of being parents. And when I was 2 years old, they left me, my brother, and my older sister with Johnny, who lived in western North Carolina. At the time, my father worked as a police officer in Washington, D.C., and my mother stayed with him there. We didn't see much of our parents for the next 4 years. When I was 6, my father was hired by ATF and stationed in Greensboro, and my parents took Johnny and us with them. Although we lived under the same roof with our parents for the next 15 years, it was Johnny who really raised us. She cooked our meals, took us to church, helped us with our homework, cheered for us at ball games. She was a mother to me, and I grew up calling her Mom. Her passing left a giant hole in what was left of my inner core. The investigation had mushroomed to the point that I'd lost all touch with my real life. I had spent more time with the Mongols than with my family at Christmas. At the same time, the indifference being shown toward me by ATF brass, as well as our frequent clashes with bureau administrators, had made me start to question my priorities. I hadn't been able to take much personal time in over a year, but Mom's death was different. Here, my priorities were completely in focus. For the first time, I didn't ask my ATF bosses if I could take time off from the Billy St. John role. I told them. I was going back to North Carolina to bury my mother and spend some time mourning with my family. I told the Mongols I wouldn't be around for a while because my mother had died. Then I picked up the pieces of my broken heart and went home to be with my family. When I returned to Los Angeles, still deeply hurting, I tried to shake off my emotions and get back into the game. I arrived just in time for the Mongols' New Year's run. It was going to be held at a cheap motel in Cerritos, a middle-class bedroom community on the southeast side of Los Angeles County. The community itself is nice enough, but it has its seedy sections. The fact that the Mongols gravitated to the seediest motel in town came as no surprise. At about 5 in the afternoon, I motored up to Evil's house, parked my bike in the front yard, and went to the door. Evil immediately gave me a smothering hug. "Sorry about your mom, brother," he said. "I love you." I thanked him. Evil couldn't see it in my eyes, but I was frozen in space, unable to move as I watched him walk away. He was the first person other than family to offer me condolences. I had been back from the funeral for several days. I had met with several ATF agents, and not one, not even Chacon, had expressed their sympathy to me. No one from ATF had sent a card or uttered a word. I realized that I was just another number to ATF. I wasn't Bill Queen, a flesh-and-blood man. I was ATF badge number 489. Without warning, I felt some ancient wall crumbling inside me. I wanted to grab Evil and tell him everything, the whole goddamn story. "Look, brother," I wanted to scream, "get your fucking shit together or you're going to end up in prison." And at that moment, I didn't want to send him to prison. I slumped into his tattered, beer-stained sofa, holding back tears. I heard another Harley roar up in the front yard. This time it was J.R. He had gone to a fast food joint to get something to eat. I remember thinking that JR needed another fast food run, like he needed a chapped ass. The sound of his bike brought me back to reality, and when he strolled in with his greasy bag of burritos, the first words I heard were, "Billy, sorry about your mom." I reached out for the usual Mongol handshake, followed by a sincere hug. "I love you, Billy." I was stunned. The tears welled up again, along with rivers of regret. I sat back down on the couch. What the fuck are you doing, Billy? I said to myself. I suddenly felt that Evil and JR were the best friends I had in the world. Maybe I could take them both in the back room, beat their asses, straighten them out. Tough love, that's all I needed. My mind was racing and my lips were murmuring wordlessly. I sat in some kind of waking trance, trying hard to hold on to what I knew was right. Domingo and Rancid rolled in, and the scene played out again and again. By now I was beginning to fantasize about riding off with the Mongols and never returning to ATF. I drank a cold beer with my brothers and wondered if any of them had ever felt such inner turmoil. Did their consciences ever torment them like this? Several hours later, we rolled into a hellhole of a motel in Cerritos, and I remember looking at all the bikes lined up and all the Mongols milling around in the parking lot. I was getting back in the game. I saw Red Dog and a couple of other bad actors that I had a real hard-on for, guys who seriously needed to go to jail. I took a deep breath as I got off the bike. As I looked around, now surrounded by a horde of outlaws, I reminded myself, I'm a federal agent, and these people would kill me without a second thought if they found that out. It wasn't what I should have been concentrating on, but at that minute, in that situation, what I needed was a sobering dose of reality. I pulled off my helmet and tucked it away. I walked toward the motel, shaking hands and greeting Mongols as I went. I made my way to the bar and grabbed a beer. Everything was going to be okay. As I turned to walk back toward where the SFE chapter guys were, I was approached by Ray Ray. He was a huge, bear-like man of Mexican descent, and I had bought enough dope from him to put him in prison until he was a very old man. "Hey, Ray Ray," I said. He pulled me to his chest, gripping me in a big Mongol bear hug. "Sorry about your mom, my brother. I love you." All I could do was stand there. I'd only just gotten my faculties back, and I wasn't prepared for the tumult and internal challenges confronting me. They were trying to pull me to the other side. One after another, bikers bear-hugged me, expressing their condolences about my mom, telling me they loved me. I couldn't help myself. I felt overwhelmed by a shameful guilt, like lusting after your best friend's wife. I watched the Mongols hugging and high-fiving, laughing and toasting the New Year with beer. They exchanged war stories and put their tattooed arms tightly around one another. They put their arms around me. They freely and sincerely expressed their love for one another and for me. It was sincere. I knew that they honestly loved Billy St. John. And at that moment, I desperately wanted to be Billy St. John. Yet every time I started to believe the Mongols were truly my friends, every time I dream about riding away with them, they'd do something that would snap me back to reality. Their truly criminal, often murderous nature would hit me in the face like a freezing wind, and I'd tell myself, okay, now I remember. Easy was the epitome of the outlaw biker, in serious trouble with the law his entire life. He was unstable and unpredictable. Although he belonged to the Los Angeles chapter and could most often be found down at Tony's Hofbrau, he enjoyed hanging out with us at the SFV chapter. He was inked up heavily with gang and prison tattoos. He shaved his head, and although not much taller than me, he was powerfully muscular. He wore his colors like they were bulletproof and seemed to have no compunction about killing for the club. He often hungered for confrontations, even deadly confrontations. He was truly fearless. Most nights, I was glad he was on our side. When I first met Easy, he was dealing with the death of his father. I was hanging out with him one night in an apartment near the place. We sat in the dimly lit living area, and he talked about his father dying, and I talked about losing my mom. Easy said he and his dad were very close and had spent a lot of time together before he died. I thought about my old man and how my relationship with him was quite the opposite. My father was hardly ever around, and when he was usually drunk. But Easy missed his father dearly. He told me straight out that since his father died, he didn't care about living anymore. He really didn't give a shit. I began to realize that Easy was so brave in the face of danger because he wanted to die. Like a terrorist who straps explosives to his own body, Easy had that conflation of suicidal and homicidal impulses. He was ready to die, and he wanted to take whoever was in his way with him. I watched Easy snorting the remainder of his meth and listened to him talk in the most chilling and morbid manner. I now learned that prior to becoming a Mongol, Easy had been arrested for child molestation. His own sister had accused him of molesting her two small children. I was surprised to hear this and surprised that the Mongols let him in the club. Child molesters are not well thought of in any society, including the most hardcore criminal elements. They're the first ones to get stabbed when they get to prison and often have to do their bids in protective custody. The room seemed to get even darker when Easy told me how he was going to get revenge. He wanted his sister to really feel some pain, the kind of pain she had inflicted on him. He was going to kill her two children, and then he was going to kill himself. As I watched him talking in the half-lit living room, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. Easy grew angrier and more animated. I've been around enough bad guys in my career to know that this wasn't just idle talk. He was going to kill his sister's two children slowly in front of her. Beside me, Easy pulled his knife out and gripped it tightly in one hand, saying that he was going to hold the kids by their hair and cut their throats while his sister watched them struggle for their lives. I sat stone silent, stunned. I didn't know what to say. Easy had worked himself into some kind of a trance while talking about it, and I wasn't about to tell him he was fucking nuts. I wanted to calm him down, so I told him that it would probably be better to just kill his sister, that the kids didn't do anything to him. No, Easy said. Killing the kids first was the only way he could make his sister suffer enough. I told Easy that I had plans to meet with someone else that evening and had to leave. As I rolled away, the picture of Easy grasping a small baby girl and cutting her throat kept running through my mind. I had to do something about it immediately. I wasn't going to be able to sleep if I kept this to myself. I grabbed the phone as soon as I got home and dialed up Chacon. "Billy boy, calm down," he said. "What happened tonight?" I told Chacon about Easy's plan, making sure that he understood it was not just angry, boastful talk. The next day, Chacon went to work on Easy's background. He found out that Easy had indeed been arrested for child molestation. The question was what to do about his sister and her children. If they were warned about Easy's plan and it got back to Easy, it would be obvious where the information came from and my own life would be in jeopardy. We had no grounds to arrest Easy, so the only solution was to have ATF put a tail on him 24/7. For as long as it took, making sure that he never had a chance to act on his plan to murder his sister and her children. Rocky wasn't as homicidal as Easy, but like most Mongols, he would gladly kill over money. As it turned out, his wife was a proficient thief. One day, Vicky and a girlfriend, Pam, managed to steal a baby grand piano from a storage unit. But they had no one to fence the thing, and it was taking up their whole tiny living room. I was lying in my bed in the undercover apartment, just starting to doze off, when the phone rang. It was Rocky, sounding upset. "Yo, Billy, I need your help." "Sure, Rock, what do you need?" Rocky and another Mongol had pawned their bikes to a drug dealer named Ruben, who owned Mohawg's motorcycle shop in El Sereno. Time was running out for them to come up with the money. Reuben was threatening to sell the bikes if he didn't get $2,000. Rocky started to tell me of his plan to get his Harley back from Reuben. "This is what we're going to do," he said. "You're going to come over with your car and take me to Reuben's. We'll park in the alley behind his place and wait. I'll go in and tell him that I want to buy some dope. I'll follow him back to where he keeps it, and when we're back there, I'm going to blow his fucking brains out. When the heat cools, we'll go over and get our bikes. Simple as that. Rocky, are you fucking nuts? We'll get caught. Somebody will hear the gunshots, go outside, and see you getting in my car. I'll go to jail for murder right along with you. That ain't gonna happen. You'll be in the alley. Nobody's gonna see anything. Now get in your fucking car and get over here. You're gonna dust him for $2,000? Sure, he's a piece of shit anyway. Maybe, but he ain't worth spending the rest of your life in prison over. Rocky was not going to be easily dissuaded. He was sure that we weren't going to get caught and wanted me to hurry and get over there so we could put the murder plan in motion. I tried to talk him out of it, but he only grew more angry and insistent. Finally, I told Rocky to hold on for a few minutes and I'd call him back. Chacon had left for the weekend with his fiancée, so I put in a call to Special Agent John Carr and laid Rocky's crazy story on him. "Wow, Billy," Carr said. "That's a good one. I don't think ATF's going to go along with you driving the getaway car on a murder." I told Carr that Rocky was hell-bent on killing Reuben that night, and I was afraid that if I didn't stay on top of him, he would take off and do it without me. From a legal standpoint, acquiescing to a murder was tantamount to participating, and neither was a viable option for a federal agent. Carr and I tried to figure a way out of this one. We could have an LAPD cop waiting in a black and white to stop us on the street for some traffic violation, come up with a bogus warrant on some chicken shit charge, and arrest me, Rocky, or both of us. Or maybe I could fake a car crash on the way over. Then I remembered the grand piano that Rocky's wife had boosted. I knew it wasn't going to be easy to fence a stolen grand piano in outlaw biker circles. I told Carr I'd offer to buy the piano for $2,000 so Rocky would have the money to get his bike and the murder would be off. Carr said that it sounded pretty crazy, but it was worth a try. I called Rocky back. "Let's go, Billy," he said. He was getting impatient, and I'd never heard him sound so intense. I told Rocky that I just talked to Bob, the guy we'd done the guns and meth deal with, and that Bob wanted to buy the piano for $2,000. You can take the $2,000 and get your bike back, and you don't have to worry about spending the rest of your life in jail, and neither do I. What do you think? I was expecting the idea to get shot down immediately, but Rocky was silent for a good 10 seconds. Then he said, "See if you can get Bob to give you 25 for it." "Okay, Roc, get right back to you." I hung up and tried to catch my breath. Here I was trying to keep both of us out of prison, or so Rocky thought, and he wanted to haggle over stolen property prices. That's the true criminal mentality. There was no time to screw around, trying to call the ASAC to see if he'd approve the $2,500. I would have to foot the bill myself and put the paperwork in later. "Rocky, brother, it's a go. Bob's sending me the money, and you'll have it tomorrow." "Yeah, okay, cool. But I still want to dust Reuben's ass." "Lighten up, Roc. Reuben'll get his." He paused to think it over. "Fuck it," he said at last. "You're right. Adios, brother." I hung up and slumped back into bed, trying to figure out how I was going to write up an ROI explaining that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms had come into possession of a natural wood-finish Wurlitzer baby grand piano. In addition to taking the position of Secretary-Treasurer of the San Fernando Valley Chapter, I also became the club's unofficial doctor. I'd never intended for the gang to learn about my medical training. While serving with the Los Angeles ATF Special Response Team, I'd become a licensed medic and still had a bag with my surgical tools, syringes, and anesthetic. One night back when I was prospecting, we'd been trying to break into the house of a Mongol associate in order to party with some girls. I was working on the window with Evil when suddenly his knife slipped and sliced my palm deeply, nearly to the bone. I could see that it was going to be good for at least 3 or 4 stitches. The party was off as far as I was concerned. As I fired up the Harley, making a tourniquet of my bloody shirt, I was faced with an undercover dilemma. I could go to the hospital as a Mongol biker, sit there until sunrise, and deal with the no-insurance bullshit. Or I could take the risk and go as an ATF agent and use my government medical insurance. But not only would that be a dangerous security breach, I knew that if the ATF administration ever found out about the injury, the SAC and ASAC would have a pretext to shut the case down. I decided to go home and sew the wound up myself. I broke out my suture equipment and the lidocaine, gritted my teeth, and pumped up my hand with a syringe big enough to start an IV. When it was numb, I went to work. With only one hand to pull the needle and surgical thread, I did a pretty lousy job, but it was good enough for government work. When Domingo and the rest of the chapter heard how I'd sewn myself up, they all started calling me Dr. St. John. And they didn't hesitate to call me when they needed some emergency medical care. One night, somewhere after 4 a.m., the phone woke me. I heard Domingo shouting frantically, "Billy, get up and get over here!" "Over where?" "Evos, he beat the shit out of his old lady and we need your help. She's gonna need some stitches." I shook the sleep from my head and sat up. "Hey, Domingo," I said, "just take her to the emergency room." "Fuck no, Billy. Evil just got out of the joint for beating his old lady. If we take her to the emergency room, they'll call the cops and he'll be right back in. Now get over here, brother." I told Domingo to hold on, that I would be there as soon as possible. 4 o'clock in the morning. Jesus Christ. I climbed out of bed, threw some water on my face, and got dressed. I called Chacon and told him that Evil had beaten up his girlfriend and that Domingo wanted me to go over and see what I could do to fix her up. "Good boy," he said. "Let me know how it goes." I grabbed my helmet and leathers and headed for the door. I didn't take my medic bag. There was no way I was going to sew up this girl. It was dark, I was tired, and I couldn't believe I was headed back to hook up with the Mongols at this hour. At least I wasn't going to have to deal with any traffic, and there wouldn't be many cops out. I hit the street and hauled ass to Evil's place. Evil met me at the door, freaking out. "I fucked up, Billy," he said. "I fucked up bad. I don't even know how it happened. I didn't hit her that hard." We walked back to the bedroom. I saw his girlfriend lying on the bed. Over and above her upper lip were several small pieces of scotch tape that were obviously holding that part of her face together. I felt like Marcus Welby making a house call, leaning over her and asking how she was feeling. She didn't answer. Given that the man who allegedly loved her had just beaten her to a bloody pulp, I don't know what answer I was expecting. I sat down beside her and began removing the tape. Once I got it all off, it was obvious what had to be done. I had seen the results of Evil beating on his girlfriend before. A few bruises here and there, maybe a fat lip, but this was bad. Evil had opened her up completely, from her lip almost all the way to her nostril. The gash was going to have to be sewn on the inside as well as the outside. I had never done that kind of intricate stitching before. I told Evil that I couldn't do it, that she would have to go to a doctor. "No way!" Evil shouted. He made it clear that he wasn't going back to the joint for this one. I told them to make up some story for the emergency room doctors. Tell them she fell down the stairs. Evil said he told them that story the last time and they didn't go for it. "Just please sew her up," he implored. I told them that even if I did sew her up, there was a great likelihood of infection with this kind of wound, an infection that could easily prove fatal. I told them that she would have to go to the doctor for antibiotics anyhow. He said he could handle that. He could get his hands on the drugs, and that I should just go ahead and sew her up. I told him again that I had never sewn up anyone from inside out, that I just couldn't do it. She really needed to go to the doctor. With resignation in his voice, Evil said, "Okay, fuck it. I'll just tape her up." He began to tape the wound closed again. It was obvious they weren't going to take this poor girl to any hospital. I knew that the time for sewing wounds closed was limited, and that if that period ran out, surgery was required. She was a pretty girl, and they were willing to scar her face for life or let her die of an infection just to keep Evil out of jail. Knowing that they weren't going to take her to get any medical attention, I relented. I told Evil that I would have to go back home to get my equipment. I headed for the door, thinking about the consequences of sewing her up. Then about the consequences of not sewing her up. Time was running out. I made up my mind and put my face in the wind. After a quick round trip to my UC pad for my medic's gear, I prepped the bed and myself for the job. I had a couple of suture kits that allowed for a combat-acceptable, sterile surgery environment. I had the appropriate suture materials for her face and the lidocaine that would make for a relatively painless procedure. I drew the lidocaine into a syringe and looked her in the eyes. I asked her if she was sure she wanted me to do this. She looked at Evil, then back at me, and nodded. She never flinched or blinked. I guess, being Evil's old lady, she had developed the sort of metal a lot of soldiers would admire. I administered the lidocaine and went to work. It took 5 stitches on the outside and 4 on the inside to close the wound. When I was through, I looked at my handiwork, and I must say, it looked a hell of a lot better than the one-handed job I had done on myself. Not bad at all. Evil was amazed and kept thanking me emphatically. I told him that we weren't out of the woods yet. She would need to be on Keflex, penicillin, or some other antibiotic for several days. Evil said he could get the drugs from Doc, a Mongol from the Pico chapter, who had some kind of pharmaceutical connection. Evil hugged me. I turned and told Evil's girl that I would be back in a couple of days to look at her. She didn't open her eyes. She didn't move. "Thanks," she said. I packed my medic's bag and headed for home. Chapter 13. Domingo had come out of prison for his felony assault conviction shortly before I met him. As a parolee, he couldn't test positive for alcohol, let alone weed, coke, or crank. Any hint of illicit substances in his weekly piss test would send him back to prison immediately. He wouldn't even hang around in a room where others are smoking pot for fear of inhaling enough residual stuff to show up on a test. I had ridden my president's coattails on the dope issue for a good portion of this investigation. When the drugs started coming out, I ran to find Domingo. As president, he was always offered any hits before I was, and when he turned them down, I was on board quick. "Hell no," I would say. "If my prez ain't doing it, then I ain't doing it. I'm hanging with you, prez." To reward this kind of loyalty, Domingo had entrusted me with a lot of responsibilities within the chapter. In addition to being the secretary treasurer, I'd also been put in charge of selling off any surplus firearms the chapter had acquired. When Domingo got off his parole, the level of violence and craziness around me intensified dramatically. I began to worry that the investigation was going to spiral out of control. It started to seem like we couldn't go anywhere without getting into a fight. Domingo was drinking like a man desperate to make up for lost time. I watched his personality change with the alcohol consumption. Once a predictable and reasonably sensible person, he was now turning into an irrational, violent asshole. It was a Saturday, and we had been invited to party with the Orange County chapter at the Shack. The Shack was a nice little tavern that had the biker flavor, but was still able to maintain a clean enough image to draw a regular law-abiding crowd. I was hoping to use the party as a chance to pick up some intel on the criminal activities of the Orange County chapter. I told Chacon I didn't need him to ride back up on this one, as I didn't expect there to be any violent activity. But I hadn't factored in the variable of Domingo's new post-parole mood. With all the administrative headaches in the ATF's L.A. division, I was looking forward to getting away with my Mongol brothers. In spite of their obvious criminality and character flaws, I'd started to care about them as human beings. It was beginning to pull me apart. I knew, on a conscious level, that I was only doing my job as an ATF agent, but the guilt from knowing I would someday have to testify against guys like Domingo and Evil and Rocky was becoming increasingly disorienting. We rolled into the Shack, where more than 50 bikes sat in the parking lot. The wind carried the aroma of carne asada. We left the keys in our bikes, knowing they would be safe among our brothers. As we walked to the bar, our Orange County brothers warmly greeted us. Beer was quickly brought by the prospects, and we settled in for a day of partying. I shot pool with the guys and took their money most of the time. With everyone full of Budweiser, the line at the little one-stall bathroom was deep. I was standing behind Domingo, who became vocally impatient at having to wait. "Look, I gotta piss," he said, kicking open the door to find a seriously inebriated guy standing at the toilet holding his dick. He wasn't pissing, just standing there staring at the graffiti-covered wall. We looked at him for maybe 15 seconds, then Domingo snapped. "Dude, other people need to get in here." Too drunk for his own good, the guy turned and glared at Domingo. "Well, you'll just have to wait, buddy." Without warning, Domingo charged in like Jack Lambert in the glory days of the Steelers, spearing the dude up against the wall. Thwack! I charged in behind Domingo, trying to look like I was doing my loyal Mongol duty, but in reality, wanting to make sure that my president didn't end up killing this drunk fool. I figured if I could maybe pin him against the wall, or put him in a half Nelson, I could get him out of the bathroom before Domingo's rage got out of control. But Domingo was already kicking the guy in the ass and back, and his head had slammed hard against the tiled bathroom wall. When I loosened my grip on his shirt, the guy lifted his head to reveal a frightening sight. Blood was streaming out of his ear. Had we given him a brain-damaging blow? Thankfully, he wasn't unconscious, just seriously drunk and stunned. Suddenly, enraged again, Domingo pinned him against the wall in a chokehold, threatening to finish the job. The guy was given the option of drinking the toilet water or losing his front teeth. But before Domingo could start smashing the guy's head into the toilet bowl, I heard a group of Mongols calling through the bathroom door. "Hey, Domingo, hold it, dude. That's Johnny's brother." Domingo was unrelenting, ramming the guy tight against the wall. "You thirsty, motherfucker?" "Domingo, brother, lighten up." Domingo loosened his grip. The guy stood motionless, blood pouring from his ear. I looked into his pupils, searching for further evidence of head trauma. I couldn't help myself. The medic in me needed to know how badly he was hurt. I held his face in my hands and turned his head so I could see exactly where the blood was coming from. With relief, I saw that it was oozing from a gash in the top of his ear. Domingo rammed the guy's head down violently into the filthy toilet until his face was half submerged in the water. "Domingo!" called one of the Orange County Mongols, pushing his way into the tiny bathroom. "Billy, that's my brother!" Domingo eased his grip at last, yanked the drunk's face out of the toilet. The guy staggered out of the bathroom. His face was blotchy and bright red, hair standing up in spikes from the toilet water, and blood still pouring from his ear. He wanted out, but Domingo was determined to make him work for his freedom. He stayed in the guy's face all the way to the front door, challenging him to make a move. The Orange County Mongols continued their effort to calm Domingo, but he was drunk and beyond talking to. Like a mad dog, he taunted the guy all the way out into the street until he was on his bike and pulling away from the shack. Almost every time we went out drinking, Domingo got into some kind of fight. After about 10 nights straight, I had finally decided to take a night off from the Mongols. I hadn't had a decent father-son night in months. I'd called both of my bosses, Chacon and Domingo, and told them that I had personal matters I had to take care of, and that I'd be out of the loop for the evening. It worked fine with Chacon, but not with Domingo. "Hell no, Billy," he said. "Crazy Craig's here from Georgia. We're putting together a little operation." "What's up, Prez?" "You need to come over and bring your Mustang and your piece."
"We ride in 66?
"Yeah, we ride in 66. Riding 66 was Mongol code for traveling armed in civilian clothes, carrying a firearm while not flying your colors. It was a sign that something serious was going down, a murder, extortion, armed robbery. When engaging in a premeditated violent crime, the club wanted to attract as little attention from law enforcement as possible. No convoy of roaring Harleys, no telltale Mongol patches. "Okay, bro, see you in about an hour."
I knew that Chacon was up to his armpits typing up 3270s, and for a moment I wished I could give him a night off. But I knew I had to get him to rally the troops and have a surveillance team out in front of Domingo's with zoom lenses for the evidence.
I prepped my NT recorder so I could be sure to get everything on tape. I picked up my UC gun, my blue steel snub-nosed 38 caliber revolver, and opened the cylinder. 6 shots. I closed it up and tucked it away under my shirt. Carrying a gun meant that I didn't just have to worry about what might happen with the Mongols. I also had to worry about getting stopped by the cops and arrested on an illegal gun charge. I considered hiding the 38 in the trunk or under the hood, but then I thought, so fucking what? If I do get popped, it'll be for the club. From the Mongols' point of view, it's just another feather in Billy St. John's cap. As I rolled up to Domingo's residence, I was greeted by Buckethead and Crazy Craig lounging in the backyard. Crazy Craig was a country white boy out of the Georgia chapter. He had a straight job driving a tractor trailer for Old Dominion and was the proudest brother who had killed for the club. He wore an extra-large set of skull and bones on his colors as testament to that fact. The size of that patch actually rubbed some of the other brothers the wrong way. Those skull and bones patches interested me more than I could safely let on. I was always eager to learn who had been murdered, where, and when the crime had occurred. Valuable intel that could be used in an eventual homicide prosecution. But the first thing you learn upon patching into the gang is to not ask questions about matters that don't concern you. Criminal bravado notwithstanding, every member of the Mongols knows that the more people who know about what you've done, the more likely it is that you're going to get caught. They'll brag about their bar fights and other outlaw mayhem, but for the most part, they keep their mouths shut about murders. There's no statute of limitations on homicide, and California still has the death penalty on the books. I did once get an older Mongol named Glazer to tell me in a conversation I secretly recorded how he'd earned his skull and bones by shooting a Hell's Angel during the big war back in the 70s, but that was only because Glazer was too drunk to care about what he was saying. In the bright sunlight of Domingo's yard, Crazy Craig looked like he was ready to commit another murder, showing off his shiny Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum to Buckethead. Domingo walked out of the house with his own gun in hand. Rancid came next, tucking his gun under his shirt. Domingo walked up to me with a Mongol handshake and a hug and started laying out the scenario. The trouble had all started a few months before I began hanging out with the Mongols at the place. Before little Dave took over the reins of power in the mother chapter, the national president of the Mongols was an old-time biker called Junior. One night at Armin's Tavern in Tahunga, Junior assaulted another patron with a beer bottle and was arrested by the LAPD. One of the most insidious qualities of the Mongol organization is its willingness to engage in the crime of witness intimidation. No one ever gets away with testifying against a Mongol in open court. As Junior's assault case moved forward on the court calendar, Lud, who had been president of the SFV chapter before Domingo, and a Mongol named Rodney Hip, were given the assignment of making sure that none of the witnesses against Junior actually made it to court. Although Lud and Hip had made their best effort at witness tampering, they couldn't locate the victim, who came to court under police protection, testified against Junior, and helped the prosecution send the Mongols' national president to prison for 16 years. It was an unpardonable fuck-up, and the rage of the Mongol nation focused on Lud and Hip. After a hearing, they were formally expelled from the club and ordered to surrender their colors. They were also sentenced to take a beating, have any Mongol tattoos burned off their bodies, and give their motorcycles and other valuable personal property to the club. Lud accepted his sentence, but Rodney Hip fled the state. The Mongols' national officers decided that if they couldn't find Hip, they would extort his older brother Andy, who was not an outlaw biker, merely a regular guy working a mechanic's job. Domingo had put together a well-coordinated extortion plan. We even had a set of two-way radios so that Domingo could go in first on a recon mission and then radio us with the okay. What would be my chances against the 4 armed Mongols if I had to stop a murder and shoot it out with them? I couldn't let them kill Andy Hip, but if he resisted, hell, if he so much as talked shit to Domingo, I had little doubt they would beat the shit out of him, if not put a few bullets in his brain. We loaded into two pickup trucks and headed to Andy Hip's place. I adjusted the snub-nosed 38 in my waistband and smiled. I picked out Crazy Craig, my fellow country white boy, as the first Mongol I'd shoot if things went bad. Then I'd take care of Rancid. Andy Hip lived less than 2 miles from Domingo. I took a deep breath as we stopped a couple of houses away. Domingo tested the two-way radios and handed me one to hold. As Domingo walked up to Hip's door, I turned to Buckethead. What the fuck do we do if we hear a gunshot coming from inside the house? Buckethead didn't hesitate. What do you think, Billy? We go in and shoot everybody. The two-way radio in my palm crackled. Okay, guys, Domingo said. Come on in. We loaded into Buckethead's pickup and backed down the driveway. Domingo and Andy Hip were standing outside by the garage door. We escorted Hip inside his garage, out of sight of anyone passing by. It was a perfect place for an execution. Domingo and Rancid raised their shirts to show the gun butts in their waistbands. They backed Hip against the wall. I put my hand on my own gun and held my breath, hoping that Hip had enough sense not to buck any Mongols. Domingo told Hip that he was being held responsible for his brother's transgressions against the club, that he would have to come up with $1,000 immediately, or we would take possession of his motorcycle. Hip's voice trembled as he begged Domingo not to take his bike. He said that he had some money in his savings account, and that he would have it for Domingo by tomorrow. Domingo said that we'd be taking anything that we felt was worth taking from Hip's house, and that it would count toward what the Hip family owed the Mongols. Hip begged Domingo not to take any of the tools he needed for his job as a mechanic. We loaded the pickup truck with electric tools, a craftsman toolbox, several car jacks, and anything else in the garage that caught Domingo or the other Mongols' fancy. Domingo made it clear that we would be back tomorrow for his bike or the $1,000 cash. As we carted away his belongings, I watched Hip begging, practically in tears. I felt my jaw tighten as I glanced around the garage, but I kept telling myself that they would all pay in due time. When the investigation had run its course, they'd all be hearing the sound of the prison gate slamming shut behind them. Domingo and Rocky were making both my life as a Mongol and my job as an ATF agent nearly unbearable with their violent and erratic behavior. It was difficult for me to break away from Domingo's orbit for even one night. He always expected me to be partying shoulder to shoulder with him. If I said I wanted to leave the party early, Domingo ragged on me and coerced me into staying out until sunrise. During one standard Saturday night jam at the place, I resolved to leave around midnight and to spend some time with my kids in the morning. Domingo could scream till he was blue in the face, but I was giving all day Sunday to my sons. He was sitting near the jukebox with his wife Terry, and I extended my hand.
Where the hell do you think you're going, brother?
I'm out of here, Prez. I got one bitchin' chick waiting for me. It was the only excuse a Mongol would find acceptable on a Saturday night.
Yeah, okay, Billy, go get 'em.
Not long after I fired up my soft-tail Springer, a young couple made the mistake of wandering into the place. They'd never been there before and didn't know the one percenter protocol. The guy was on the big side and looked like he'd seen a few street fights. His girlfriend was in good shape, young and pretty, and unfortunately, Rocky quickly became infatuated with the way she moved. He didn't care that she was with another man. He walked up to her and introduced himself. He flirted with her and pointedly did not say a word to her boyfriend.
Back off,
the insulted boyfriend said finally. Everybody in the place knew that you didn't talk to Mongols like that. Rocky invited the newcomer to settle it outside. But once outside, it didn't take Rocky long to realize that he had bitten off more than he could chew. Although Rocky landed a blow or two, the boyfriend was bigger and stronger. The fight went to the ground, and Rocky, now on the bottom, was taking one serious ass-whipping. Domingo caught sight of Rocky getting pounded into the concrete and flew right into action, kicking the guy in the face with his steel-toed boot. The guy wasn't able to recover before Rocky joined Domingo with another boot to the head. Rocky bent down and began delivering blows to his face and head as Domingo kicked him in the back, chest, and stomach. They kicked and stomped until their victim lay completely motionless, barely breathing. This still wasn't good enough for Rocky. He reached into his pocket and pulled a knife. By this time, several people had walked out of the place, including the guy's girlfriend. She was terrified and started screaming. Just before Rocky started to stab the guy, Domingo grabbed him, saying there were too many witnesses. Some sense returned to Rocky, and he put the knife away. He reached into the guy's pants and took his wallet and money. Meanwhile, the victim's girlfriend had run to the payphone and called the police. As Rocky tucked away the money and wallet, he heard the sounds of police sirens approaching. Rocky and Domingo ran back inside the place and searched out hiding places as the cops pulled up in front. The beaten man lay motionless on the pavement. His lungs, punctured by broken ribs, began to fill with blood. The police called for an ambulance and backup units for what they thought was about to become a murder scene. The victim's girlfriend told the police that Mongols had committed the crime and gave them a description of the two bikers. In the confusion, Domingo and Rocky escaped from the place. Backup units moved in and a manhunt ensued. The paramedics quickly assessed the victim's condition and undertook the painful procedure of administering a chest tube. They worked on him for almost an hour before he was stable enough to transport. It would be more than a week before doctors were certain that he would recover from the beating. Although there were several eyewitnesses, only one, besides the victim's girlfriend, stepped forward, and she could only identify Rocky. The eyewitness went by the name of Ray Gunn. Ray Gunn was a big guy, an indigenous Tohunga barroom brawler who knew better than to try to intervene against the Mongols. But as he stood at the crime scene, watching the paramedics desperately working to save the victim's life, Ray Gunn had a crisis of conscience. He listened to the victim's girlfriend begging her boyfriend not to die. It affected Ray Gunn to the point that he stepped forward and volunteered to give the police a complete statement of what had happened. He identified Rocky and Domingo as the perpetrators of the assault, giving the police their descriptions and telling them where they lived. In so doing, Ray Gunn guaranteed himself a place on the Mongols' most wanted list. Rocky knew he couldn't go home. He ran to his dad's place, where he hid out for the next couple of weeks. Domingo had no place to hide and was confident no one on the rock would give him up. But if the victim died, Domingo decided he would go on the lam in Mexico and hang out with the Mongols' chapter there. If it looked like he was going down for attempted murder or strong-armed robbery, he would flee to Georgia and hang with Crazy Craig and the Mongols there. At about 4 o'clock in the morning, Domingo and Terry were awakened by a knock on the front door.
"Police, open up!"
Domingo was still fully dressed. He quietly opened the back door as the police pounded away at the front. Terry was confronted by several cops demanding to speak to Domingo.
"He's not home. What do you want to talk with him about?"
"We just want to talk to him," one of the officers told her.
Terry told them that Domingo didn't come home last night and that she didn't know where he was. They wanted to look in the house, and Terry stood aside as they rushed in with guns drawn. They went from room to room and were satisfied that Domingo was, in fact, not in the house. They told Terry that when she spoke with Domingo, she should tell him to turn himself in.
"Turn himself in for what?" she demanded.
"Just tell him we need to talk to him."
At 5 o'clock that morning, I was asleep in my real home in Upland when my cell phone rang. It was Terry.
"Billy, where are you?"
She was frantic, almost in tears, saying the police were after Domingo and that he had been banging on the door of my UC apartment in Diamond Bar, trying to get in touch with me. I told Terry that I was at the Chino Airport, only a few miles from my pad. She said that Domingo was at the service station just around the corner and that he needed to hook up with me. I told her I'd get in my car and meet with him in just a few minutes. Hanging up the phone, I jumped out of bed and threw on my clothes. I gathered up all my Mongol paraphernalia and ran out the door. As I raced toward Diamond Bar, I put in a call to Chacon.
"Dude, something's up. I'm on my way to the UC pad. Domingo's waiting for me. Terry called and said that the cops were looking for Domingo. Hate to do it to you, Johnny, but you better get up and head my way."
Okay, I'll roll with you.
When I hung up, it hit me hard. My kids were expecting to see me at 8 a.m., which was 3 hours away. Hopefully this bullshit with Domingo wasn't going to take long. I rolled into Diamond Bar in record time, managing somehow to avoid drawing the attention of any cops. Domingo was waiting for me at the service station.
Where the hell have you been, Billy?
He said angrily. Hey, Prez, I had to drop off that equipment at Chino this morning at O Dark 30. What got you up so early this morning?
The fucking cops, he said. Let's go to your place and I'll tell you all about it.
There was no handshake, no hug, just one serious meet. I knew some bad shit must have happened the night before. I rolled to the UC pad, followed closely by Domingo. As we parked, I couldn't help but notice that Domingo was behaving in a way I'd never seen before. He was visibly unnerved. I grabbed my keys. On my keyring was a standard car door security device that, in reality, controlled the audio-video surveillance equipment in my pad. As we walked in, I hit the remote recording button that turned it all on. Domingo started to talk.
Billy, me and Rocky beat up a dude at the place last night, and I think he might have died.
He tried to blame the whole thing on Rocky.
Rocky was getting his ass beat, and I had to jump in and save him, Billy. I guess we beat the guy a bit too much. Then that dumbass Rocky took the guy's wallet and money. Man, I gotta find a place to hide out till I figure out what I'm gonna do.
Hey, Domingo, I heard myself say. You know, you can stay here as long as you want. He said he was going to call Terry and have her bring over some clothes and things, and he'd stay with me until he decided what to do.
Cool, I said.
Good thinking, Queen. With Domingo living right on top of me, the UC pad had suddenly turned into an indefinite 24/7 operation. That meant absolutely no downtime. I'd be in full Mongo mode every waking, every sleeping moment. I walked around my pad, making sure there was nothing there that would give me away. Domingo had been up almost all night and was starting to fade. I told him to lie on the couch and try to get some sleep. He did, as I sat back, and I regretted missing another outing with my kids. There was no way I could even risk calling them to explain my absence. I sat and wondered how much more of my personal life was going to be permanently swallowed up by the investigation. Domingo stayed at my pad less than a week. He found out that the victim hadn't died, and that the police hadn't been back to his house since that night. What he didn't know was that they had gotten his next-door neighbor to watch for his return. He was home only 2 days before his place was raided, and he was under arrest for assault with a deadly weapon and strong-armed robbery. While Domingo was hiding out with me, Rocky and his girlfriend had stolen her grandparents' car and run away to Colorado to hide out with the Mongol chapter there. Rocky managed to stay on the lam for several months before he was ultimately tracked down and arrested. The police report of the assault and robbery clearly listed the name of the eyewitness to the incident. The Mongols are more criminally resourceful than they might appear to outsiders, as I'd seen firsthand during this investigation. The club has its own private eyes and attorneys on the payroll, as well as employees of local police departments and the California Highway Patrol providing them with confidential information. Domingo made bail and was back on the streets of the San Fernando Valley. It didn't take long for the police report of the assault to end up in his hands, nor did it take long for him to start trying to locate the witness whose name was on that report, Reagan. It was a Saturday night, and I was planning to just stop by the place, have a couple of beers, say hello to the boys, and call it an early night. But somewhere around 9 that evening, the kid and Conan from the Rivco chapter showed up. Conan had gotten out of prison only a few months earlier, but was working hard on a return ticket by selling drugs. He had made use of his time in prison working out, and it showed. He had an intimidating physique and a more intimidating stare. The kid, Karena's old man, was another constant headache. I dreaded his coming around because he almost always pushed me to do drugs with him. But tonight everybody seemed satisfied to drink beer. Somewhere around 10, the kid, Karena, and Conan made the suggestion that we all go to the Sundowner for another round.
We rolled into the Sundowner lot and parked in the rear as usual. There were a few cars and no bikes. It had the makings of a trouble-free night. But as soon as we settled in at the bar, Karina spotted Raygun across the room. The kid, as a chapter president, wielded more power in the club than I did, and he took charge of the situation. He began laying out plans for how we were going to handle Raygun. His options ran from murdering him to just beating him senseless. I told the kid that it should be Domingo's call. Conan insisted on beating the shit out of him at the very least. By this time, Raygun, standing at the far side of the bar with his girlfriend, realized he was in for some trouble. He tried to make his way to the door, but Conan got there first and blocked his escape. Raygun's girlfriend shuffled quickly to the bathroom. The kid sent Karina to catch her to make sure she didn't call the police on her cell phone. The kid, Conan, and I converged on Raygun. I kept saying we needed to call Domingo, but Conan shouted that he didn't want to. He felt like taking care of the guy right where he stood. Raygun was cornered, clearly shaking. Conan told him that he was going to kill him. Raygun began to plead for his life. The kid grabbed Conan's arm and told him that there were too many witnesses in the bar. We needed to drag him out back and kill him there. Raygun begged us to let him go. No civilians tried to intervene. The bar had gone silent. Raygun kept pleading and swearing that he would never testify against Domingo. I tried one more time to reason with the kid and Conan, saying it was important that we at least got Domingo on the phone and asked what he wanted us to do. All my reasoning fell on deaf ears. They were intent on killing Raygun at the Sundowner. Finally, I told the kid that if we did kill Raygun here in the Sundowner, the crime might come right back on Domingo. He'd be the prime suspect in the cop's eyes, the one guy with a clear-cut motive, and he'd better have an airtight alibi. "Yo, we really need to run this past Domingo," I said again. The kid finally eased up. He went to the payphone and called Domingo. Conan was still intent on kicking the shit out of Raygun. Raygun was trembling and almost in tears when the kid returned with Domingo's instructions. He said for us to hold him here, he's coming right over. While we held Raygun in a corner, I assessed my options. If Domingo ordered us to kill him, the case was over, tonight, right here in the Sundowner. There was no way I would let the Mongols murder a witness. I'd have to try to stop it. I could try to reason with Domingo, tell him that everyone in the bar had seen us cornering Raygun, and if we killed him, we'd all be going down for murder. If Domingo's response was irrational, then I'd have to make a stand. I had no gun, no knife, no weapons other than my two fists and my ability to reason with these killers. If it came down to it, I'd give myself up as an ATF agent in the bar in front of everybody, dial 911, and hope that the cops showed up in time to prevent a murder, Raygun's or mine. Conan stayed in Raygun's face, telling him how bad he was going to fuck him up. Raygun trembled and begged. Now I began to fear that Conan would lose all impulse control, simply stab Raygun to death before Domingo showed up. Raygun made a pitiful attempt to escape, trying to push past Conan, but Conan knocked him into the wall. "Try that shit again and we'll dust you," the kid said. At last, I saw Domingo's powerful squat figure in the doorway. The expression in his eyes was homicidal, but I waited, wondering what his decision was going to be, what my play would be in response. Domingo was considerably shorter than Raygun. He lunged right into Raygun's face, gritting his teeth, spit flying. "You'll be lucky if I don't fucking kill you!" "Please, Domingo," Raygun kept begging for his life, swearing he would never testify against a Mongol. He said that he would leave town, that he would do anything Domingo said. Domingo wanted to know why he said anything to the police in the first place. Raygun's first response was a denial, and this nearly sent Domingo over the edge. "Your name and your statements in the goddamn police report, you fucking idiot!" Raygun stuttered, apologizing, swearing he would make it up to Domingo. "Please, let me go, Domingo, please. I promise I'll never testify. I swear to God." "All right," Domingo said finally, "but I want you out of town, and if I even hear a murmur that you might testify, you're a dead man." Domingo moved to one side of Raygun and told him to get the fuck out of there. Raygun didn't hesitate. He hit the door, leaving his girlfriend behind. The victim was so badly beaten that he couldn't identify Domingo. And without Raygun's statement, Domingo's prosecution couldn't go forward. But the prosecution didn't need Raygun's corroborating statement to make the case stick against Rocky. The victim's ID was enough. When Rocky was extradited from Colorado, he found himself up to his ass in indictments and warrants. The state of California had him for assault with a deadly weapon, inflicting serious bodily injury and robbery. They also had him on Grand Theft Auto. ATF had Rocky for multiple federal drug violations and gun felonies. But in order to protect my UC identity and the integrity of our investigation, we asked the court to seal our indictments until we were prepared to do our final takedown on the Mongols. I wasn't looking forward to having to testify against Rocky, but as it turned out, he never went to trial on any of his cases. He decided to work out a plea bargain with both the state and the feds. I never saw Rocky again. When Chacon called to tell me that Rocky had been sentenced to 10 years on one of his state cases, I didn't feel great about it. Rocky had always treated me above board and did his best to look out for me when I was taking all that abuse from Red Dog. I knew that he deserved to go to prison for all the criminal activity he'd been involved in, but I also couldn't forget that had it not been for him, I might well have been stabbed to death in the fight behind the Sundowner. In fact, months later, at his federal sentencing hearing, Rocky's attorney tried to get him some leniency by telling the judge that Rocky had saved the life of a federal agent. I testified that I probably would have been killed if Rocky hadn't intervened. Rocky was not the hardened career criminal who typically makes up the membership of an outlaw motorcycle gang. He had held down a legit job as a tree trimmer for the city of Los Angeles for 13 years. And could quite easily have stayed straight for his entire life. But he'd fallen for that one percenter mirage, been taken in by the tough guy mystique of the Mongols, and it had cost him big time. It was 11 a.m., and I just rolled into the South Pacific motorcycle shop. As I got off my bike and went inside, I was met by J.R., the hulking prospect who'd helped me carry my soft-tail Springer up the stairs to my undercover apartment. "Billy, did you hear what happened last night?" J.R. made a slicing motion across his neck. "What the hell does that mean?" "We stabbed a dude at Nino's." Nino's was a popular bar down in Commerce near the Mother Chapter. I'd been down there a few times to meet with Leno Luna. Evil came out of the back room, taking a break from working on a stolen bike. "Yeah, Billy, I lost my knife last night," he said, scowling. "Panhead stuck some dude at Nino's with it. Then he tossed it. Somebody owes me 40 goddamn bucks for that knife." This sounded like more than just a routine bar fight. As nonchalantly as possible, I reached down and activated the digital recording feature in the Motorola pager on my belt. JR and Evo proceeded to lay it out for me. I listened, nodding, taking careful mental notes for what might be an impending homicide prosecution. After leaving South Pacific, I called Chacon as soon as I could and relayed the information about the incident at Nino's. I told him that not only had the Mongols beaten a civilian, but they claimed to have stabbed him to death. Chacon said he'd look into it with the Commerce cops. He called me back in less than an hour. "Yeah, Billy," he said with a new urgency in his voice. "Get all you can on that stabbing at Nino's. They're right. The guy they stabbed died." By the fall of 1999, we'd amassed a long list of federal racketeering crimes against the Mongols. Drug dealing, illegal gun trafficking, stolen motorcycles, extortions, assaults. But we couldn't yet make a homicide case. This was frustrating to Chacon and me, and to the U.S. Attorney's Office, because we knew that the Mongols were responsible for a number of unsolved murders in California. But it really came back to that old truism of police work. It's not what you know, but what you can prove. Now I went to work with renewed vigor, eager to get proof of the homicide in Commerce. As best I could, I established the scenario that had unfolded the previous night, November 25th, 1999. It had begun much like the episode with Rocky and Domingo almost killing their victim at the place, a routine disagreement over a woman and a jealous husband who had the temerity to stand up to the Mongols' aggression. The mother chapter had been holding church at Leno Luna's house in Commerce. When church broke up, they headed to Nino's, the nearest bar. Around 9 p.m., a young woman named Sandra Herrera and her girlfriend decided to stop in at Nino's for a drink. Although Sandra had seen the Mongols at the bar on several occasions, she didn't know any of them by name. She had never seen them at their worst and had little insight into their violent nature. As hard as it is for many people to fathom, there's something about that tattooed bad boy biker image that intrigues certain women, even straight, law-abiding women like Sandra. Some Mongols rolled into Nino's lot, parked their bikes, strolled into the bar, and headed straight for the beer. The music was loud, and the presence of a couple of unescorted women gave them a reason to stay and play. Not that it ever meant much to the Mongols whether a woman was escorted or not. Panhead didn't have much regard for anyone and needed little provocation to explode into a blur of violence. In his mid-30s, he sported an array of Mongol tattoos and had the true gangbanger look of East L.A. He often wore a black bandana pulled low over his forehead, so low that he had to cock his head back just to see straight ahead. Panhead had zeroed in on Sandra and her friend, offering to buy them another round of beer. When they agreed, Pirate, Coyote, and Cowboy joined Panhead at the girls' table, while Little Dave kicked back and watched his boys circling like a flock of vultures. The possibility of a Mongol gangbang was looming in the air. The Mongols bought beer for the naive young women, who seemed to enjoy the attention. Then Sandra's husband Daniel walked in. Daniel Herrera was a 42-year-old working-class guy. He and Sandra had a nice little place in Commerce and a couple of kids. He occasionally stopped in at Nino's to have a beer or two and wind down after work. Though a large man, he wasn't known as a troublemaker. Daniel wasn't looking for a drink this night, and he wasn't looking for a fight either. He was just looking for his wife. By this time, however, as far as the Mongols were concerned, Sandra belonged to them. Daniel was more familiar with the Mongols than Sandra was, and he approached them with caution. In a calm tone of voice, he asked Sandra to come home. His reasonable request hit the Mongols like a brazen insult. He was trying to put an end to their hunt. Everyone waited for Sandra's response. She told Daniel that she wanted to stay and have another drink with her new friends. The Mongols were more than ready to back her play. "It doesn't sound like she wants to go home with you," Panhead said. Daniel knew better than to tell a Mongol to mind his own business. He ignored Panhead and again looked at Sandra. "You've got two kids at home who need dinner, and we need to get out of here." The Mongols now told Daniel pointedly that perhaps he was the one who needed to get out. He was being offered his last free ticket out, but Daniel stood his ground. Panhead backed out of the group and hooked up with JR, who was holding Evil's 8-inch buck knife. Panhead ordered JR to hand over the blade. Daniel Herrera wouldn't get a second chance. No one had the power to stop the Mongols now. Daniel had allowed his anger at his wife to get the better of his judgment. "Fuck you then, bitch!" he yelled in her face. "And fuck the Mongols!" Daniel turned and headed for the door. The blows from fists rained down on him from all directions, but he was still able to make it to the exit. If he could get outside, he might escape with just a few cuts and bruises. He struggled with the Mongols, and he did make it out the door. But the Mongols were now in a frenzy. They kicked and beat Daniel until his face was covered in blood. After a long struggle, he finally managed to get away. He ran as fast as he could, but the mob of Mongols caught him and resumed the beating. One Mongol fist after another pummeled his face and body until he was nearly unconscious. Then Panhead jumped in and plunged the buck knife deep into his back. The knife pierced his chest. Daniel could no longer fight back. He stumbled a few steps more as blood began to fill his lungs, suffocating him. He fell face down on the pavement. In the weeks following Herrera's murder in Commerce, I moved carefully among the Mongols, constantly recording my conversations on digital devices. I managed to get dozens of explicit conversations on tape, implicating Panhead and several other Mongols in the murder. I always played dumb with my questions, or tried to sound like I was filled with genuine outlaw awe. I told Panhead that I admired what he did, that I envied the skull and crossbones patch he'd earned by killing for the club. Panhead told me that he did what he had to do. In another conversation at an L.A. muffler shop, I talked to Panhead about sticking that dude. He was careful not to admit the murder outright, though he didn't deny it. Finally, my interest in the killing got me in hot water with the mother chapter. I was at the Easy Rider convention when several Mongols, including the National Sergeant-at-Arms, backed me into a wall and questioned me about why I was talking so much about the murder. They read me the riot act. "Billy, keep your fucking mouth shut about Panhead and the dude at Nino's. Do you understand?" But by that time, I'd captured more than enough on the wire. As a result of those taped conversations and my eyewitness testimony, we were confident that when we closed down the investigation, we would bring a murder prosecution and get a conviction in the slaying of Daniel Herrera.
End of Disc 6.